I thought we'd begin with something rather cheerful. And if you know nothing about jazz, there are probably three names you do know: Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and Benny Goodman. In 1978, on London Records, the 40th anniversary concert at Carnegie Hall was recorded, the anniversary of the great 1938 Benny Goodman concert. And he introduces Mary Lou. The tune is Roll'em, which is perhaps her most famous song and arrangement arranged for him, including Camel Hop, which was his weekly theme on the Camel Caravan during the 30s. The tenor saxophone is Buddy Tate, who was the surviving Kansas City tenor man. There's a short trumpet solo by Jack Sheldon, I think, who is mostly hilarious on the Merv Griffin show from time to time. And I've seen him on those space programs, Rod Serling, as an actor. And Mary takes the piano solo, and Benny plays very fine clarinet. So we'll listen from the 1978 40th anniversary concert, Benny Goodman's Mary Lou Williams' Roll'em.
Great lady who wrote this piece, and she never played it with me. I think it's about time. Miss Mary Lou Williams.
Form of the Blues, Boogie Woogie, one of the first. I think that's as early as 36 that she did that arrangement. I'm not sure exactly, 36 or 37. She had done other Boogie Woogie arrangements for the Andy Kirk Band, including Little Joe from Chicago, from which Dorsey got his hit a little bit later in the early 40s. Certain figures in that particular arrangement were used for another recording. 1978, but the style there is swing. Mary Lou's career is highly interesting. Not only is she the most important female instrumentalist and composer in the history of jazz, but also a constant change and evolution in her own work without dropping what came before. When I asked her last night what she'd like to play, I said, Dan and I and Martin are doing this Jive on You tomorrow. What would you like to hear? And she said, one of Benny Goodman's Good Rollums, and then that record I did in the cookery. The sound is not so good. Hank O'Neill had a little engineer in the cookery in New York, nightclub owned by Barney Josephson, who's the owner of the legendary Cafe Society uptown and downtown in the 40s in that same city. And Hank came in there to record Mary Lou live at the cookery. His label at that time was called Chiaroscuro. That was an offshoot of another label called Halcyon, which Marion McPartlin inherited. Sherman Fairchild, the aviation man, together with Hank O'Neill, invented Halcyon and recorded a number of, maybe about 10 LPs or so, I'd say in the late 60s. When Sherman Fairchild died, Marion inherited the name of the label together with whatever LPs she had made for the label, and all the other tapes went to Hank O'Neill, who began a new label called Chiaroscuro. The first job I got for Marion Records was for Chiaroscuro, an album called From the Heart, 9 piano solos. I don't know what in the world Hank used, a tiny tape machine in a small little studio on West 58th Street, rented from a woman named Grace. That's all I remember. Later on, he recorded Mary in his own studio on Christopher Street with Buddy Tate, album called Buddy Tate and His Buddies, and then this. The tune is I Can't Get Started. When I did a radio show with one of my students at Duke, I gave him half the stuff, and he called this tune I Can't Get It Started. I said, no, baby. So, if we can have it a little louder this time, because very slow and very beautiful, and the major interest is the denseness of the harmonies, beautiful harmonies, which are particular to her, modern, but particular to Mary Lou as well, and very beautiful feeling. The bass player is Brian Torf, a white bassist who is currently working with George Shearing. So I can't get started. This is Chiaroscuro, CR-146, live at the Cookery. Someplace in the early or mid-70s, something like that, I forget exactly. Thank you. October 1975, according to the liner notes by Hank O'Neill. It's a very nice cover by Johnny DeVries. Crazy cover, painting. Mary Lou is a stained glass window. And on the back is a photograph, another in the sequence taken by Ole Brask, the photograph that appears in Dan Morgenstern's book called Jazz People, surrounded by children in the cookery, Mary Lou, in the back. It's very nice. A different angle from the one Dan used. Very nice. Okay. Her first solo recording, earlier in 1930, when she was still 19 years old, kind of a stride style, someplace in and around James P. Johnson, whom I consider to be absolutely fundamental in the history of jazz piano, or jazz in general even, a monumental figure for me, and then his star pupil, Fats Waller. This recording was made for Jack Capp, Brunswick, and Mary did not know she was being recorded. She simply thought he wanted to hear what she could do, and so she recorded this unbeknownst and also composed it on the spot. Her first record under her own name, and this is called Nightlife. A tiny little lady at that time, weighing 90 pounds, and she says she got her first recognition because of that left hand, playing strong like a man. She knew a guy named Parker. Jack Howard. I'm mixing up Jack Parker, the drummer, Jack the Bear Parker later in the 40s, whom she was also very close to. But this guy's name was Jack Howard, and she said he played the piano so hard he broke up the keys. So as a little girl, she was very, very imitative and ears wide open, but if she liked something, she did it. and I think that heavy left hand came from him. And whenever asked about her influences, she always mentions J.P. Johnson first. Then she talks about listening to piano rolls of Jelly Roll Morton, The Pearls, which she recorded later in the 30s. But James P., I think, was her first hero. Then Earl Hines, naturally. Art Tatum, later on. She always mentions Tatum first, Bud Powell second. Then she talks about James P. as the first thing, and then Earl Hines. So those four monumental figures in the history of piano early. Later on, of course, she, Bud Powell, and Monk were inseparable during the 40s at her little apartment, daily almost, before Monk achieved wide recognition. And she tells one story about the three of them trying to compose a piece simultaneously on her little three-quarter upright Howard piano in her apartment with Monk coming over, and he reached up and grabbed Bud Powell by the tie and all this business. But that must have been a muddy mess, those six hands on one keyboard trying to create a simultaneous thing. I don't know if a tape exists. Her archives are very diffuse in her house, and I have an awful lot of work to do to clean them up and extricate and find. Okay. Her recording career begins, as far as I'm able to find out, in 1927, when she was 16 years of age. The record I have here is called Midnight Stomp, and I forgot to bring my Xeroxes of Jepson and all the rest of it, Dan, but 4117-2, Jeanette Cinco Jazzers. Seymour and Jeanette were a vaudeville team, strutters, you know, cakewalk and that kind of thing. One of the very few black acts that were on the big TOBA, not the TOBA, but the Keith Orpheum circuit at that time. And Seymour died in 1926. Jeanette went out alone then as a single. And John Williams, her first husband, alto sax player and one of the first baritones in jazz, had a group called John Williams Syncopators, John Williams Memphis Stompers, then it was Jeanette James and her Cinco Jazzers, or Jeanette James's Cinco Jazzers, depending. It's only about eight sides that exist from that period, all of them in 1927. And as far as I know, this is Mary Lou's first piano solo, and the tune is called Midnight Stomp. We'll stop the recording right after the piano solo. It says here, Chicago, January 1927. I have this, I found this in Canada on one of our treks up that way. This is Arcadia, a reissue. Dick Rachelson. It's 1975, the reissue. And this is the only place I've ever seen anything under John Williams' name on LP. where the originals, I don't think Mary Lou has these. She has a lot of things from the Andy Kirk period in the late 30s, and maybe some of the ones done in Kansas City in 1929. But John is still alive in Columbus, Ohio, and primary on my, he'd be about 75 or 76 years of age now. And primary among my objectives very soon is to get to him and try to interview him at length for what he may know, both for Dan's collection of the oral history of jazz at the Rutgers Institute, and also for what information he may be able to contribute to Mary Lou's early history and his own. That's a pretty good solo he took there. I like that. He very, very quickly faded. He became a member of Andy's band and did a lot of the business maneuvering for Andy Kirk's band, a great deal of it, and especially keeping the musicians in line and working together in the right way. But he faded as a soloist. And he even mentioned this to Mary. He said, well, you were the one with all the music, you see. And he became functional shortly rather than original. But he'd made these records on his own. I've already mentioned Andy Kirk and his 12 Little Clouds of Joy, or his Clouds of Joy, or his Swinging Clouds of Joy. They made recordings, the Kansas City Band, as early as 1929, reissued on Ace of Hearts. The British are wonderful for gathering these things and getting them back out, Europeans, especially the British. In 1936, a year before the really important sides done by Count Basie for Decca, Andy Kirk recorded five or six sessions in March of 1936. And Mary's favorite arrangement, or the most important arrangement I think she did for Andy Kirk, was called Walking and Swinging. The second chorus is particularly interesting, where she wanted to add the sixth in a chord. Andy told her, you can't do that, it's against the rules. She said, that's what I hear, just a mild little simple thing like adding a sixth to a chord. She had three saxophones, so she stuck a trumpet in a hat. And the second chorus, this arrangement was bought by a lot of the bands and played by them because musicians like that second chorus, and I like it too. She's doing a symphonic kind of thing now, writing for a wind symphony and piano, bass, and drums. And when she gets to the period of Kansas City, I would like her to do this tune for that big idea and see what it would sound like. This is called Walking and Swinging. March of 1936. It's a style the Kirk Band was famous for, to a light, swinging, lovely thing. Not the fire of Basie, it's another kind of thing. Dick Wilson, wonderful tenor man. small group from the Kirk Band recorded under the heading of Six Men and a Girl in 1940, and Mary likes this session. She's not very happy about her recording career. I very, very rarely heard her respond favorably to anything she's done or recorded. This is largely true with many creative musicians. They don't get what they hear. They don't like it. But she likes this session, and she liked that for some reason. She liked that Can't Get Started. She always said, I like that. There's a chord or something or other she felt good about. But this session, again, Six Men and a Girl, notable for the presence of Dick Wilson on tenor, who was kind of forgotten in the history in a way, because his whole career, aside from this one session outside the Andy Kirk Band, and still a small aggregation from the Kirk Band, his entire recording career is on Decca with Kirk. And I think they have a few, Dan, I don't know that series of fine discographies put out in England. There are a couple of things from Uptown in Harlem, just before he died, about a month they have, jam session things. So he's not well known. He's not like Lester, not like even Herschel Evans in a way, certainly Coleman Hawkins, a monumental figure. And Dick Wilson is forgotten in a way, but it's a very, almost a... hard tone, and it presages a kind of a modern thing. This is still purely swing, but his approach is a kind of a modern push to it, I think. Had he lived, Dan and I were discussing this yesterday, had he lived, he died in 41 or 40, right, shortly after this session, I think he would have made the transition very, very well into modern bop. So this is Zonkey, Fats Waller's tune, Zonkey, Six Men and a Girl, four sides, one of four sides done for Varsity in 1940.
Thank you.
most successful record so far. That's perfect within its frame to me. It's just right. And she said that session that had a lot of love in it. Everybody was feeding everybody just exactly right, you know, more or less just head, you know, you, and little background, and slight arrangement on one or two of the other things, but more or less just a sketch, and then boom, it worked correctly. Reissued on Savoy this year, 1980, Arista Records, Savoy, LP called The Black Swing Tradition, Fletcher Henderson, Mary Lou, Stuff Smith, Hot Lips Page, lots of nice Hot Lips Page on that. She wrote for Duke Ellington also. I think we'll skip Trumpet No End. After she left Kirk in 1941, she traveled for about 6 months with Duke's band and arranged many things for him during that period. Her husband at that time was Harold Baker. The trumpet player became lead trumpet for a long while with Duke, and she would sit in every now and then, as Duke would have people sit in at the piano from time to time, but mainly she wrote things. And the most famous thing, the only thing that I ever saw recorded, as a matter of fact, is a version of Blue Skies, which she did for the poor guys in the trumpet section, nearly tore their throats up, called Trumpet No End. But we'll get to something else, which is, as far as I know, this is, well, there are two discs of this. I have one. It's Mary Lou Williams with the... I guess members of the New York Philharmonic. It was she wrote the Zodiac Suite in 1945. Barney Josephson presented her in concert with an 18-piece band with some strings. The band included Ben Webster on tenor. I don't know where in the world those tapes are, or whatever in the world they use them. I know that Timmy Rosenkrantz had them. You know, he sliced them somehow or other and flew away to Europe. And I would like to, if anybody has leads on that, that's very, very important and totally lost. The 12 Signs of the Zodiac, which she first did on WNEW radio. I have many acetates of those. Tommy Nola took them down for her. The Nola recording studio's off the radio, and they're all home in a big tin box waiting for me to get to work on them and get Mo Ash or some good soul to put them out. That's a man who should be very interesting to all of you. Mo Ash, Folkways Records, Disc, and Ash Records, an incredible, lovely, wonderful man, vigorous as hell to this moment, and he must be near 80 and the crusty as you can get. How old is Mo?
Well into his 80s.
You know, and he's just as healthy as, oh, and he's just wonderful. He just makes me scream. But when Mary went to ask him for money, burst into tears, just like, I have no money, and tears come down. So anyway, then Mole recorded the Zodiac Suite in the studio, the 12 Signs, piano, bass, and drums, and that came out on Folkways, two volumes, you know, three 78s in a, you know, those... photograph album type things, you know, and reissued recently on Folkways. And then she scored the same suite for this 18-piece band plus about four strings. Those were recorded at Town Hall, where the tapes or whatever, the wires or whatever they are, or the discs, I don't know. The following year, in 1946, she set three of these pieces for symphony orchestra and her piano. One of them is nothing more than a little encasement of an arrangement. It's a piano concerto. It's the piano version with a little decoration. And I have this one copy, you know, made by the guy who hangs up by his heels in the top of Carnegie Hall. And a girl in Syracuse has a copy that you have to put the needle in the middle and it goes toward the edge. And she said, where in the world can I find a machine to make this work? So this is the sign Aquarius, Mary Lou's piano. And Norman Granz had a series of pop concerts at Carnegie Hall in the mid-40s. And this is from a live concert at that time. This is Aquarius then. Thank you. symphony people ever tried to accompany and work with. There it is, and don't steal it. Good, okay. Benny Goodman played bop once, believe it or not. This is another thing I discovered in Mary's files. It's called Benny's Bop. I am not sure of the personnel. I'm sure it's in the discography. I think the tenor is Wardell Gray. Mary is the pianist. Mary is the arranger and the writer of the tune, and Benny takes a solo. I imagine this is someplace around the late 40s, and Mary worked with Benny's sextet in the late 40s, writing for it and playing with him. There was a big blow-up. She had two big blow-ups, one of many, I imagine. She's very laconic and quiet and shy, but sometimes when she says things, she says whammo. She got very angry at some deal with Capitol Records and went around and grabbed all the music and split the scene, and Capitol froze her out for a good long while after that. The other was when she took vocal background arrangements to Nat Cole in the early 40s, and the staff arranger used her voicing instead of using Mary's stuff. So she had a little bit bad experience with Capitol on two occasions, one with Nat Cole and one with Benny. Where these were recorded, I have no idea. I just don't know. That's the function of Dan's enterprise and the kind of things all you people are interested in, rooting down the sources and whatnot. Anyhow, an acetate from her collection. This is called Benny's Bop. This and one more tune, and then we'll be finished and talk with you. Tune I'll play for you is called My Mama Pinned a Rose on Me. Mary began to record for Norman Grant's on Pablo again in 1977. She did a joint concert with Cecil Taylor at Carnegie Hall in April of that year, and he recorded that live, followed by two LPs. She did a solo session in the morning. A wonderful engineer, by the way, Bob Simpson. I don't know if any of you know him, for Victor. Very fine engineer, for this kind of music anyway. And we were waiting for the bassist to arrive for the afternoon session. He was late. And I asked Mary to sing this song, which is an old blues ballad her stepfather taught her in the early 20s, called My Mama Pinned a Rose on Me. And it was so funny that I said, put a mic out there to Bob. She is never, she's not a vocalist at all. And this, I think, is the only occasion on which she appears on record singing. And she's recorded this tune three times at least, once for Moash. It's a record called The History of Jazz, which she made on a little tape recorder in her own apartment full of all, I had 139 edits to do to get that thing clear. She said, Art Blake Lee. I had to get the L out of that word. This guy was sensational. I forget his name. And all sirens and the window fell and everything else and papers as she reached up to put the thing on and play the keys again. Earlier for George Simon on a jazz tone label. 1955, she put together a very careful history of her own work up to the sounds of Monk during that period, back to Fandangle, A Piece of Ragtime, and Sweet Sue, and Boogie, and this Mama Pinned a Rose on Me, a blues ballad of the 20s, and then the third time for Norman. Not only did he like the thing and keep it on there, we were fooling around during lunch, but he made the LP the title, My Mama Pinned a Rose on Me. So we'll finish with that, and then field whatever questions you have or comments. This is 1978, December 78. So a little further ahead, I think there's a mistake on the slice. You know where that space is supposed to be? That's good, fine, all right.
Everybody could see. Everybody's talking about the way I do. I'm gonna leave this heart of town. I'm gonna leave before the sun goes down. Everybody's talking about the way I do.
Okay. Dan, would you like to come up here and sit in also? Make any comments? Yeah. And Martin Williams, the great critic and historian of this music, also.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm Leslie Gerber. Is this thing alive?
Yeah, okay.
I'd like to know what Mary Lou Williams thought of her sessions with Cecil Taylor and what she thought of how the collaboration came out.
She liked the second half very, very much. They were at loggerheads the whole first half of the concert. There was music written and everything else, but the two of them were just like that for the whole first half. Once Cecil played his own music, the first two compositions in the second half of the concert are Cecil's compositions, and she followed him, you see. And actually, I think it's, she's very, very pleased with the second half. And even on the first half, there are moments that are illuminating, I think. A lot of loggerheads the first half. But I think the second half of that kind, there's nothing been done like that at all anywhere. I mean, that kind of two, you know. So that's what she thinks. Gary Giddens likes the record very, very much. In the music, and he was very, very perceptive. I mean, that's an awful lot of complicated music to hear right off the cuff. And his piece appeared not a day or so later, and it was very on target as far as, I mean, he was pretty accurate. And he has a book out now called Writing on a Blue Note, published by Oxford. And it's 30 pieces from, you know, rebuilt from his Weatherbird pieces in the Village Voice. And the review or description of that concert is one of the pieces.
Yeah, I'm Paul Jackson. I recall, and maybe you can remind me of what this was. There was some TV program or some news clips on TV about a birthday party in Central Park in New York or something with Mary Lou Williams. I remember seeing clips of it on a news program, but I don't remember the occasion. It wasn't too long ago.
I wish I knew.
It's in the last two or three years, mm-hmm. I think. And then the second question, if you knew about it, do you have it in your archives?
The film that I know about, Tom Guy of New Jersey Public Television did a very good hour and 10 minutes on her, which was centered around the Mary Lou's Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral in 1975. Also, film at the cookery, film from her scrapbook, interview in her apartment in Harlem, walking down Fifth Avenue, all that kind of stuff. And I don't know if there was anything. She's had any number of birthday parties that had children at them. At the cookery, for instance, kids from her parish up in Harlem brought down to have a party with her. And also, Dan Rather did a 5-minute piece that went coast to coast on CBS Evening News several times, and there could have been some footage about a birthday party in that.
I used to get a lot of phone calls beginning, I do still, but particularly about 10 years ago, a lot of phone calls from rather avid members of the women's movement who wanted me to tell them who the great women jazz musicians were. Singers excluded always, because they were obvious enough. And I was pretty hard put to answer that question. And when I was asked it, I often forgot Mary Lou, and I guess that's the highest compliment I could pay to her, because I simply Good. Didn't think of her in a subcategory. She functioned with some of the best, obviously. I wouldn't have picked that Benny Goodman arrangement, God Bless the Blues, by the way, because that's what that is, and it's the only original musical form that the United States has ever come up with, folks. And if you don't know that, I guess we all should. But I would have picked a piece called Lonely Moments, which seems to me the most
beautiful.
Interesting thing she wrote for him. Mm-hmm. And I'd also like to say that there are lots of people who could have written for Benny Goodman and lots of people who did. But there's only one person I could think of who... Well, there are two or three, actually, I can think of. But she is one person I could think of who wrote for both Goodman and Ellington, and there are not many of those. Mm-hmm. And there, again, is a compliment to her.
Yeah, Mary says, I don't belong in with the women, she usually says that.
Her absolute dedication to grow is a compliment to her. And there are many male jazz musicians who did not have that quality. They were perfectly content to maintain, if they could, the level they reached by their mid-20s and mm-hmm. live off of that for the rest of their lives. She was not content to do that at all. And so seeking that kind of perfection was very much a part of that all jazz musicians are after, but sticking to that for a whole career was a part of her life.
Yeah, she and becomes rather
her musical
bored.
Life.
Yeah.
And also, the final thing I remember about her was an evening that the New York Public Library at Lincoln Center, the music library at Lincoln Center produced about 10 years ago, dedicated to Scott Joplin, in which she was one of, Peter Bergman was involved in this. If you want to know more about it than I can remember, but there were three solo pianists there, the terrible two of the Joplin revival, of course. I don't mean that negatively, just, Josh Rifkin and Bill Balkin both played. And Mary Lou came out and she played three Joplin pieces and immediately started to augment and ornament, because that is music to her. Mm-hmm. And of course, all the scholars surrounding me where I was sitting were just upset and outraged that she's not playing Joplin. But music to a musician of her caliber and her kind is not something you can memorize or read. It is something you can make. Mm-hmm. And that's what she did that evening. And they, of course, didn't understand that. It would have been an outrage to her talent on her part if she had done anything else.
Mm-hmm. Vera liked that. Vera Lawrence, who put together Vera had no objection. I was very nervous, as a matter of fact, precisely for that reason, how all these people would, and, would they get very mad or something. And it wasn't Joplin. It was more or less Mary Lou a la her swinging left-hand style, and then all the harmonies got much more complicated than what she would have done during that period, too. Yes, dedication, that's right. And very, very bored with the last thing she did. That's how she got hung up with Cecil. She wanted to prove something. She wanted to prove something, too, that there was not such a diffuse separation, not such an exact separation. Also, it's interesting, she was 68 years old when she did that, 67, totally new idea. Yeah.
Peter Bergman, I was involved, as Martin said, with that recital. It was the first all Joplin recital, by the way, ever given in this country. And when we asked Mary Lou Williams to participate, it was expected that she would bring to the Joplin rags her own kind of music and her own feel for it, and we did anticipate that. I was up in the booth. I was operating the lights for that recital, and we were taping it up there. The record was ultimately issued privately by the New York Public Library.
Yes.
And there were 10 of us, I think, up in the booth, and we had listened to Josh Rifkin play and to Bill Balkin, and Mary Lou started to play, and everyone in the booth began to dance. It was just uncontrollable. The reaction up there was ecstatic, and I think that was carried through into the Treminisha excerpts which followed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She was very angry at me for bringing those things to her, because Vera approached me at that time. I brought the music to Mary, and one time she threw the stuff at me in her living room. She said, take this, because it was very hard for her to enter into that particular approach, which predates her own life. By the time 1910, 1917, the ragtime she plays is a ragged style swinging some kind of thing. It's a ragging piano, very different from Joplin's approach. And especially the Chopinesque stuff, the rather classical approach. She found very difficult to enter into that and try to, she said, what am I going to do with this? And it took her a while to figure out how to approach those things. And the reviews were not unanimously in her favor either. Would depend, But you're right. And the audience went crazy the minute she hit the keys. It just went wild. They weren't expecting it.
I think the only review I remember of that was, Wilson in the Times, and he said she walked away with it. She mm-hmm. put some life into it, which is precisely what she did. Mm-hmm. One thing I would like to say about Mary is that during the time when there was when modern jazz came on the scene, bebop, as we now call it, Mary was, along with Coleman Hawkins, whom she knew and played with and recorded with, among the few established musicians who was very sympathetic to this new music, and not only sympathetic to it, but encouraged it. She, of course, used it herself and in some respects contributed to it. But you mentioned the gathering in her apartment with Bud Powell and Monk, but there used to be regular gatherings there. I think her apartment was a real meeting place for people, including people of different generations. I remember a snapshot in Metronome, or something. Maybe it was staged, but it looked natural enough, which had, you know, Jack Teagarden and Dizzy and
right.
I think a very
Hank
young
Jones.
Hank Jones, right? And that was a, you know, very lovely thing for her to do. But she always had, I think, I didn't know Mary then, but she always had the feeling of, you know, responsibility about the music.
Even if she was angry at any note, anything, even somebody who did her in, if they're playing, I have never heard her misjudge anybody's music. She's wide open to whatever is being done, as you say, a real expression from inside. And any sound, boom, right there. They're crazy. Musicians are really crazy. They're different from us. There's something happening in there that's inside, and they respond in the most unusual, highly interesting, creative ways. It's amazing. You could say to Mary, your mother just died, and if she's right there in the middle of something, it will not register till later. You see, I've seen that. Dizzy's like that. He looks funny, but really what's happening is something's going through up here. Some strain is going through his head musically, you see. Miles is of the same caliber. And Monk, absolutely. They're all of that caliber. It's a world inside their heads. And I think Mary, she's just an authentic musician. And so when, you know, whether it's Christian or Benny Goodman, Mel Torme, all those people were up there simultaneously at various times. So,
well, she was one of the few who could have brought them together, I guess.
Yes.
They all.
Well, one thing, I feel uncomfortable standing up here when I'd rather relax and talk back and forth. And maybe there's some others here who have that same problem. So I think I'll stand up here with you if you want to come up here and not feel so uncomfortable.
You should just break it up and do it that way.
Yeah, might
at
be.
At this point.
The thing about finding recordings, I wondered if any of you had contacted Frank Gillis at Indiana University. He's a jazz musician, piano player, and has his own private collection as well as that at the university. He might have some material. He played in the Detroit area with Glenn Gray.
Oh, yes.
And
she liked him, too, the Casa Lomas. She was crazy about the Casa Lomas.
And then Hazen Schumacher at WUOM works with a collection of about 25,000 recordings that came from Neil Diamond. And there might be something there. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my own Mary has formed a foundation. It's called the Mary Lou Williams Foundation. The purpose is to teach gifted youngsters between the age of 6 and 12 through already musicians. A musician would be funded to teach a given child for a certain period of time. The other part of the foundation which I contributed to, which was my idea, was to preserve her image and her music in various ways, and I would hope to put together some kind of a comprehensive set of recordings sooner or later, one way or another.
Peter, let's break it up and make it one-to-one, can we?
Sure,
And talk to people without microphones.
So this would be very important to me very soon, how to find as many original 78s or whatever even better than that could be found. Very important to me,
Peter?
Archival.
Don't play those acetates anymore. Get them on tape. Don't
right.
play them, because every time you play them, you lose some portion of what's on there, and since those are rare and maybe unique, even in the case of that Carnegie Hall thing, I would suggest that you just put them on a cassette or something, and then let them be until the time comes to, you know, to make
a
recording.
Studio and make a recording. Yeah.
I'll be thrown out of the hotel if I don't check. I was promised them I'd be out of my room at 12:30, so I'll say goodbye, and I think Peter deserves a nice big hand for him.
Since we do have people with schedules and flights to meet and so forth, what I suggest is that we'll conclude the official part of the conference at this point. If you want to stay around and talk a bit, by all means do so. We have this studio for the rest of the day. At about 1:30, the collector swap will begin in this room. At that same time, out the door and to the right, down the corridor in the viewing room there, the Mary Lou Williams videotape and the BBC videotape that Joseph Pengelly brought with him will be shown alternately. So thank you very much for coming, and this concludes the conference.